We'll call together and to order the Thursday, January 19th, 2017 meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. We do have a quorum present, and we're still waiting on a few folks. So what we're going to do is we're going to put off the approval of the minutes, and we will go to our first presentation, which is item number 4. Yesterday, we had an opportunity to hear from the State Board of Investment and from 4 of the 5 pension plans here in the state of Minnesota. Given the time constraints, we have asked Jill Schertz, the executive director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Plan, to come this morning, and she has graciously accommodated that request. And at this point, I would ask Ms. Schertz to come to the testifying table. And members, you should also have in your packet the information from yesterday's presentation. Her information and materials were in that packet. And for reference, they look like this. And as Ms. Schertz and company are getting ready, we do have a quorum present. Representative Lee, have you had a chance to review the minutes from yesterday's meeting?
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes for January 18, 2017, and I move it.
Representative Lee moves the minutes from the January 18, 2017 Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. Any corrections? Seeing none, hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Ms. Schertz, welcome to the committee, and again, thanks for being accommodating to our need to have you come back today. Greatly appreciate it. And folks, you have Ms. McDonald with you today as well. We eagerly await to hear from you, and if you would go ahead, provide us your name, your position, and begin with your testimony. Again, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you mentioned, my name is Jill Schertz. I'm the executive director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I'm joined today by Ms. Christine McDonald, the deputy director. Thank you for having us today. We greatly appreciate the opportunity. Now, I will say that yesterday I was thinking I had about 4 minutes, and that might have been more exciting than this, but I have been told I have, 2 hours, and so I can stretch this presentation out endlessly.
Ms. Schertz, that's not what I remember just moments ago when we talked about this.
So we will actually try to make this fairly succinct. First, we will be dovetailing on many of the comments made by our colleagues yesterday. So to the extent they've covered off in great detail on some of the areas, we'll try to be much briefer. But first, we want to give you a governance and oversight review of our organization, talk about our membership, the composition, the benefit structure, our financial status, and then give you a sense of the legislative proposals that you'll be seeing this year and the rationale behind it. So if I could start on page one, just very briefly, we serve the licensed teacher principally of the St. Paul Public School District. This organization has been around since 1909, so we're in our 107th year of providing retirement benefits to this group of professionals. We're governed by a 10-person board comprised of active and retired St. Paul Public School teachers and one ex officio member from the St. Paul Public School Board. As well, we're subject to oversight by the Minnesota Legislature and principally the LCPR, as you know. We're audited annually by the Office of the State Auditor, and we're very pleased to report that we have an unbroken record of unqualified opinions. As well, we benefit greatly from the professional expertise of our actuary, a nationally recognized firm, Gabriel Roeder Smith. I'd note that we share that actuary in common with MSRS and PARA, so we see many of the same issues and get invaluable insight through those relationships. And then finally, at least from our perspective, we're a professionally managed firm with a staff of 7. I feel very grateful to have Ms. McDonald on board. She's a 14-year pension veteran at St. Paul, as well as bringing to us 10 years of experience from the Office of State Auditor before she joined us. I come most recently from serving as the chief executive of an investment management firm in New York, banking, the legal profession in the military before that, and I'm a native of Peoria, Illinois. As we move on to talk about our membership, and one of the reasons I think Chris and I do this job is our fundamental belief in the importance of teachers and the role that they play. You've heard in great detail yesterday from my colleagues at TRA about the importance of the pension. I'll just focus philosophically on our view of that. We think as we look across our, in particular, our district, we think teachers are the backbone of not only the middle class, but they actually stand at the gate. They are the gatekeepers for all of the important social and political issues we face today. And as you look at just the pie chart and the composition of our district, we are one of the largest. But as you look at this, you can see that we have 72% of our students are below the poverty line. We represent immigration and racial issues to an extent that's not seen most places in Minnesota. We think that these teachers perform a very important role for us as they determine the next citizens and leaders of Minnesota. With that in mind, we think our covenant is to provide in perpetuity dignified and secure retirement for them. And that's how we approach our mission. When we look at our membership breakdown, we have in common with most of the other teacher associations across the country a group dominated by women, 73% to 75% here are women. You'll hear later how that also factors into the mortality issues we'll talk about, as women still tend to live a little longer than men. We have a diverse population. And contrary to, I think, what some people may perceive, this is a solidly middle-class group from an income perspective. As well, of the approximately $111 million of benefit dollars that we distribute annually, the vast majority of that, almost 90%, remains right here in Minnesota. And I note that it's not just the St. Paul distribution. This money, the benefit dollars, are distributed throughout 59 counties in Minnesota. If we turn to page 4 and dig a little deeper into our membership, you'll see that we have roughly 12,000 members comprised of active and retired. We have and administer two plans, a basic and coordinated. And you heard about this yesterday. Basic plans really mean that they do not receive Social Security. That represents sort of the historic legacy of our plan. That plan stopped taking new members in 1978. But they do comprise the largest portion of our retired base. We will focus, when we talk about our plan, principally on the coordinated side, because that's our active membership today. I will note we have three remaining coordinated active teachers left with in excess of 35 years of teaching experience, and they are well into their 70s, so hats off to the three of them, of course. When we look at our membership, the average active member is around 45 years old today, and our average retirement age, as we noted here, is around 64. One thing I'd like to point out when you look at that statistic, often we'll get a question about, isn't it true that teachers can retire early and walk away with a generous pension? The reality is there are pretty significant, it looks like there might be a teacher in our midst, there are very significant penalties in place for early retirement. And this in large part had been in existence and then was strengthened in 2012. So to give you an example, if you're 55 years old and you want to retire today in our system, you would incur a 55% penalty on your retirement benefit. So, rough justice, if you're looking at a $1,000 a month payment, you'll only get 55% of that, so $450. So this disincentive for early retirement is very significant, and we've seen, again, this have quite a dramatic effect on the average retirement age. Over the last decade, it's gone from 59 to 64 and continues to move up. As I mentioned, basic plan members don't receive any Social Security. So as you look at the right-hand side of this page, you'll see that their benefit structure is higher, but that's also because during their active years, they paid more into the system. As well, I think that there's a perception, again, about this rich benefit structure. When you look at simply our coordinated plan member today that's paying into the system, our average coordinated plan member will walk away with about $1,500 a month in benefits. If you think about that on an after-tax basis, that's roughly about $1,200. So while that plays an important role on providing that dignified retirement, it certainly is not a rich benefit. Again, I smiled when I saw that number of $18,000 annually. That's roughly what I received as a second lieutenant in Korea about 30 years ago. Some people would think of that as their salad days. I think of those as my ramen days. So again, we think the benefits are very in line with appropriate levels. If we turn to page 5, I'd like to just walk you through kind of what this board has done over the last 5 or 6 years in order to make sure that we keep this plan in a fiscally responsible place. And again, I'd share with you kind of the board's philosophy on this. I think as a board and certainly as the leadership of this, our view is we're not so much a benefits organization as we are a very important financial engine. that in turn, if run properly, will provide benefits in perpetuity. So we focus very much on the financial side of this equation. And as we look over the last few years, the actions that have been taken by this board, you can see that we voluntarily and proactively lowered our investment return assumption or our discount rate last year, along with MSRS and PARA, from 8.5% to 5%, or 8.5% to 8%, rather. Now, that comes at a cost, and we did it without additional funding. So as a fund, we bore the cost of about 0.9% of pay, but we did it because we thought it was an important and fiscally prudent measure. We also, as a board, have significantly reduced the COLA benefits over the years. We are and have been at a flat 1%. I'll share with you that if any of our members are here, they would feel free to tell you that's not an entirely popular position. But again, keeping it at 1% has done a large amount to improve the fiscal condition of this fund, and keeping it there for the long term, I think, goes a long way to assuring that we can pay these benefits in perpetuity and keep our covenant intact. As well, over the last few years, we've increased, with the legislature's approval, employee and employer contribution rates, and as I've already mentioned, adopted early retirement reductions. So what does that all mean? As you look at the right-hand side of the page, you can see that that's led to very meaningful improvements. If we look from fiscal year 2012 to today, this board has taken the plan from quite a negative position, depending on whether you look at actuarial or market, minus 6 or minus 7% as a percentage of pay, all the way to where we will be, are today, plus the next increase at 0.67 on an actuarial basis. As fund directors, we look at that, and if we stop the story here, we'd say that's a job well done. You're sort of within the range of rounding errors, and you've put the plan on a very good trajectory. As we're going to talk about in the next pages, and you've heard yesterday, however, we think it's our obligation to continue to acknowledge and deal with, on a timely basis, two of the great challenges or opportunities or environmental impacts that all of our plans face today. And as you've heard yesterday, those are twofold. That's the cost of mortality, as well as the proposal to reduce the investment return assumption from 8 to 7.5. Both of these are very important. On the one hand, mortality, and again, I don't have a chart here about mortality because my colleagues addressed it yesterday. But as you heard yesterday, mortality is a factor that's not within our control. On the one hand, we embrace it and celebrate it. On the other hand, we acknowledge that it simply adds costs for us, because what it means is the longer our retirees live, the more benefits we pay. Roughly speaking, for this plan, implementing the new mortality tables will cost this plan about $60 million in additional liabilities, and we'll show in a later chart what that means as a percent of pay. When we turn to the investment return assumption, again, we are proponents of modifying that assumption from 8 to 7.5%. We believe it's an appropriate reaction in line with what we see in the investment environment. When we think about the process behind that, our colleagues outlined yesterday that it starts with an obligation of our board to continuously review the environment, the assumptions, and recommend appropriate steps. We look at the environment, and that is informed by both the investment community point of view about what expectations are on the short, intermediate, and long-term perspective. And very importantly, we're also informed by our actuaries' point of view, which in this instance is aligning with the investment community. When we factor those two in, our board has concluded that 7.5% is required and appropriate. One thing that I would note, when we look at our plan, we are coming from a historically underfunded status. We are showing consistent and steady progress. But from our perspective and our board's perspective, we are recommending the 7.5% as long as it is accompanied with the necessary funding. So again, when we look at the cost of going to 7.5%, you immediately increase your unfunded liabilities by approximately $70 million. And again, to keep your financial engine and your financial house in order, as you do that, you need to fund that increased cost. So you hear us talk about that later. As well, I mentioned this historic underfunded status. You're looking at a plan that I think has adopted all of the correct financial measures, and yet coming from an underfunded status, it is incredibly difficult to make progress unless you consistently address the funding side of the house. So we intend to do that as well. We are going to talk about it in a minute, the disparity between the employee's contribution and the employer's contribution. With our approach here, we intend to address that. So as we turn to the next page, I'd like to take just a moment to talk about why in our proposal, when normally we think about the world as needing to be balanced, I want to talk about why in our proposal you're going to hear us only focus on the employer side of the house. When we look at the current normal contribution rates for this plan, where we are today, as indicated by this diagram, we have our employees actually paying a higher cost, a higher percentage than our employers, and paying a higher percentage than the national average. When we look at the employer regular contribution, they're obviously paying lower than the employee and lower than the national average. So right now, in this year, we have a 1.25% disparity. Next year, we already have statutorily, from the 2012 session, one more 25 basis point increase for the employer. So after that, there'll be a 1% disparity. But we will still be in a situation where our employees are paying 1% more. When we look over time, this disparity has existed since 1999. When you translate that into thinking about how you manage a fund, since 1999, that 1% disparity has resulted in about a $77 million shortfall for the fund. And we're not here today to ask for that or in this session. What we are here to say is financial stewards, we need to start addressing that. And we can do it over time, but we need to start today. As well, sometimes there's a perception, I'd like to address it in this slide, that the employees don't contribute overall enough to this benefit. When we look at our employees contributing 7.5% and compare it to the normal cost of their benefit, they're actually contributing 77% of that. So if you think about that as, you know, an analog to your 401k and your matching system, our employees are doing an excellent job contributing to their retirement. And I would tell any of them that were here, this is still a fantastic benefit, but they're paying for it. Now, if we go to the next slide, I just want to walk through our proposals for this year. At the end of the day, what we're trying to get to is as complex as pension funds are, it's to simplify it. And at the end of the day, if you take care of that financial engine, they are fairly simple. On the right-hand side, you can see that we have a starting position of this 1.76 deficit, and that's expressed as a percent of pay. So that's the problem if we were sitting here today with nothing else we'd be trying to solve. But we've already mentioned we're going to take on the cost of mortality. Again, we'll have our experience study this year, so while we are living with that cost now, we'll actually implement it in this next session. We have a minus 1.49% cost there. The 7.5% return assumption, should we adopt that this year, would cost another 2.18%. And then we start looking at some of the cost savings measures that we can implement as a fund as well as the additional funding. So we start going through that. We are recommending against the legislature, and our board has approved, eliminating any COLA trigger increases. Now, in our plan, like some of the others you've heard about, statutorily, if we hit a certain funding rate, there's an automatic increase. I would say two things about that. While that feels good, and it feels good to have that in the statute, it in some way artificially adds to your current cost, and it actually places a burden on your active teachers, because that possibility of a future increase gets factored into the plan's cost and factored into what your active teachers have to pay. And in these situations, what you'll see is while the actives are bearing the cost, the likelihood of the retirees seeing that benefit in their lifetime is very small. Our board weighing that has decided that that is not a close call. Eliminating that benefits both actives and retirees. So again, post-proposal, you'll see us not only maintaining our 1% in perpetuity, but eliminating any built-in increases. That will save us 0.31% of pay. You've heard yesterday about updating the CSA load factors. This is a savings that's common to all of the plans. It's simply based on, in prior years, the actuaries were forced to do an analysis of what it might cost the plans as their employees, they're able to have portability of benefits, what that might cost. Periodically, they reassess those costs, and they've determined the initial assumption was too high, so they have recommended lowering it. That provides us with a 0.77% savings. We are proposing a 3% employer increase. That sounds like a large amount. We don't deny it. But what that does, it gets more alignment with where our employees have been, and it brings us to the same contribution rate that is being recommended by our colleagues at TRA, which means all teacher employee lawyer associations would be paying the same amount. And finally, we would reset the amortization as the other plans would do to a new 30-year period, consistent with all the plans to 2047. Now, importantly, when we go back and we talk about that employer contribution piece, it's important for us to note, as our colleagues did from TRA, that we're recommending that we provide that funding through the state education funding mechanism instead of being on the back of the individual districts. As well, you see that we're recommending an additional state funding amount of $5 million. And we're doing that because this plan is coming from a historic underfunded status. If you do that, as you look at the bar chart on the bottom, you'll take your plan, which has shown steady improvement, and you'll get it to 95% funded. In the absence of any cost savings measures or funding proposals being implemented, if you move ahead with mortality, which we must, and you choose to implement the interest rate assumption, the plan will go from showing steady improvement to bottoming out at 52%, which we think is not a fiscally prudent way to run a public pension plan. So with that, I'll stop, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Ms. Schertz, thank you for your presentation. Ms. McDonald, is there anything you'd like to add to this, or were you just there in case the phone a friend was needed?
Exactly. I'm the phone a friend.
She is absolutely my lifeline.
We do have a question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which of the testifiers could address. I'm just curious, you know, looking at the basic component, when that was phased out, what were the tops of the step and ladders in the district? Just an idea of...
From a salary perspective?
Sir? Yes.
Ms. Schertz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I apologize. I do not have that data. We could certainly take a look at it and find out. I don't have it with me. Because we're talking, sir, about a salary perspective, the districts, what they pay their teachers, not what we pay them in retirement.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that would be offline is fine for that. And then looking at your presentation, is the basic component of your disbursements, you know, that pool of retirees, is that the main contributor to the reason for requiring these reoccurring, millions of dollars at a time, bailouts for the state?
Ms. Schertz.
Chairman O'Driscoll, Representative Quam, thank you for the question. I think it's an important question. When we look at the composition of our fund, and every year we step back and do the demographic analysis, and we kind of think of it as the iceberg, because where we look at our liabilities, we break it down by age, by type, type of plan, et cetera. We're applying probabilities of longevity, et cetera. And we clearly do see that the majority of our liabilities simply come from today, our basic members. But I will say that as you see that the every year that goes by, the iceberg moves, and the composition becomes more on the coordinated side. So what I would say is this is a grim business sometimes, but as we lose basic members and they are replaced by coordinated retirees and the membership base is more dominated by coordinated, you'll see the liabilities simply decrease. So that's just statistically a fact. What I would say in terms of your second comment, which goes to funding, I would say that is cannot be answered by one factor alone. I would say that clearly we do have a higher cost structure with a mature plan. I think all of the plans that are mature and have that basic component would point to that as one component. But also, as you look back historically at this plan, there's a very clear record of underfunding at many terms. As well, I think I showed you the disparity and an underfunded status between employee-employer. So at many turns, when you have an event like that over a period of time and you allow it to persist, that simply contributes to an underfunded state.
Representative Quam, follow-up?
Mr. Chair, if I'm hearing this right, as you stated, the historic underfunded status is then, yes, relational to the fact that the large component of your retirees that are underneath the basic, which is over twice the benefit as the the current teachers, and over 150% over the average, that is the cause of the historic underfunding. And if staff could also maybe get some information for, I understand that Minneapolis and Duluth plans have similar, as the testifier stated, icebergs. It might be better for me to understand if we have some data so we can see what's underneath the water and maybe try to plan and address. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Plum, just to do a couple of follow-ups on that, I'm going to take one. I'm going to toss the other part back to Ms. Schertz on this. Although at one time the state of Minnesota did have a separate Minneapolis fund and a separate Duluth fund, those have been since merged either into TRA or into PERA or the other respectives on that. And so in order to be able to make that link, those plans had to have funding that went into them to stabilize, to be able to not cool the waters of the current people who are in that plan. And the second part of the question I guess I'd like to have Ms. Schertz address is, again, reminding us of the difference between coordinated and basic and the fact that there wasn't Social Security that was paid, and maybe talking about how that plays into the issues as well.
Thank you. So, Cheryl Driscoll, Representative Kwan. I'd go back, touch on a few points again. One, I would say when we talk about mature plans, that applies to many plans that have been around for a long time. Not just any one. Two, I would say that the basics are one factor and not even the dominant factor. But it's one factor. Three, when you think about the basic plan members, the reason they have the higher benefit is because, again, they did not receive Social Security. So at the time of their active membership, they paid a higher rate and they receive a higher benefit. The other plans, the coordinated plans, they're lower because they also receive Social Security. And that's simply a fundamental change around the country in how people think about public pension plans. That's not unique to Minnesota nor St. Paul. As well, I think it's important to focus on, again, sometimes pensions seem so complex, but they really are financial engines. And if you think about how those run and you think about underfunded or funding, it's incredibly important to focus on the three components of funding a plan. And my colleagues touched on this yesterday. It's employee contributions, employer contributions, and your investment returns. Those have to be in line. That feeds into the engine, and then it's incredibly important that what the engine produces, the benefit, is in line with your inputs. And if you do that, you'll have a great plan. So I come back to that because what I would say is, while basics and that benefit are a component, I'd say they're a smaller component. The principal component is not funding your plan appropriately. So if you allow any one of those inputs over time to be artificially low, you by definition will starve your engine, and at the same time you're still paying out benefits, and you'll have an underfunded plan. And that's in part why we're here today, say, as fiscal stewards, we're here to say we think this is the right way to feed your engine and ask for your help.
Representative Nelson, you to this topic, I'm sure, with your experience as mine on the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you were starting to touch on the same thing. The other thing we need to remember on these basic plans, the coordinated plans, they're paying into Social Security, so the employer's paying in 7.5% into Social Security as well as the employee. In the basic plan, they are not paying that, so the employer's saving that 7.5% on the other side, and the employee's then paying into the fund at a higher rate. That's why the higher benefit, when you multiply it out by that, how they figure out what the benefit is. So, I mean, when we talk about they're not getting Social Security because they're in the basic, the employer also didn't pay into that. So the employer paid, saved money over the years by not paying into the 7.5% their share in Social Security.
And because we have that subgroup within PERA and that subgroup within MSRS for State Patrol and PNF for Police and Fire and PERA, that's why those contributions, if you remember from the presentations yesterday, were at a higher limit because the employer and employer not paying on that. That is the sole source of retirement from a public entity, be it a pension or a Social Security benefit. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other point of that is these plans that were the basic plans predated Social Security. 1909 was way before Social Security was started. The police and fire the same way. They all predated Social Security, so that's why they were set up the way they were set up, and we're just there. Just that's why the benefits come out the way they come out. I think if you took this, what these people are getting with Social Security, they probably have a comparable benefit, monthly benefit, if you look at it that way. But we don't see that in this figure.
Representative Quam.
I'll step away from the posthumous equine.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you, Chair and Representatives. I would just add, in terms of the basic plan, again, to that point, is that the basic plan, we had more retirees when the COLA was higher, and it's a compounding COLA. So if we were giving out a COLA of 7% back in the days, they received that COLA the next time they got a COLA, it was on top of that increased base. At the time, there were not very many coordinated individuals who were retired or eligible to retire, so that would also have a large impact on the value of the benefits that the basic plan members are receiving over the coordinated.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. And if you would just, for the record, identify yourself.
Christine McDonald, Deputy Director.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to this committee, so I just have a couple of questions. What age do most people retire right now?
Ms. Schertz, I suspect you can speak to St. Paul teachers, not necessarily to your colleagues and where they're at.
Right. This plan.
Okay. Cheryl Driscoll, Representative Peterson. In our plan right now, 64 is the average retirement age.
That's the average. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. And then what is CSA?
Combined service. Basically, combined service takes into account the fact that our benefits are portable amongst the public plans. So it takes into account applying a cost to each of us if we have other members come to us throughout their careers.
Mr. Chair, and then how do the benefits compare to, you have a lot of national comparisons, and I was just curious how the benefits compare to the other national pensions that you're comparing the contributions.
Ms. Schertz.
Cheryl Driscoll, Representative Peterson. What I would say is we haven't done that comparison here, and internally I don't know that we've undertaken a full study of that. My sense from talking to colleagues and looking at some of the NEA data, if we look at multipliers, for example, that we are either below or on, you know, no better than on par. I think if you look across the landscape, you would not say this is a rich benefit structure.
Representative Peterson.
And one more question. So your additional ask, I guess, total would be $12 million. And, you know, has your school board considered moving to a defined contribution instead of a defined benefit plan for the new hires that you have coming in?
Ms. Schertz.
Representative Driscoll, Representative Peterson. The school board has not, nor has our board. And I think that fundamentally, this goes to a deeply held belief about defined benefit versus defined contribution. And I know that this is a very broad topic, but I think that I would speak for our entire board and many of the people here in saying that universally and wholeheartedly, we believe that a defined benefit plan is a better way to transmit retirement benefits. And I'd say for teachers, because that's my membership community. But as well, when I look at the two financial vehicles side by side, and I will tell you, particularly having just retired my 72-year-old mother, who does not have a defined benefit plan, and piecing together the many pieces of her retirement equation, I have absolutely no doubt this is a better way. What I'd say is, when you look through the history of defined benefit versus defined contribution, defined benefit plans have provided secure retirements since the early 1900s. It is the only plan around that actually says, if you accept the lower amount of pay for your lifetime, I will guarantee you a steady stream throughout your post-retirement world. What that means is you can allow people to plan for their retirement. You don't make their date of retirement dependent on the vagaries of the investment environment on the day they retire. You actually place that in a larger pool that's professionally managed that can produce the right outcome. Now, again, one of the fundamental condition precedents is that you manage these plans well and that you make sure you keep that financial engine in shape. And I think all of the plans in Minnesota have done an exceptional job. And the fact that, again, not to dive too deeply into the philosophical side of this, but as you look across the country, and you look at the statistics today, about over 50% of Americans haven't saved anything for their retirement. And of the ones that have, they have saved an amount that is so shockingly below what they need to retire. I personally took this job because I think retirement security is one of the most important philosophical issues facing our country for the next generation, and we need to solve it. And as you look at the change in defined benefit versus defined contribution, I think the loss of defined benefit plans has left our country in this generation in a very compromised position in terms of retirement security.
Members, other questions for our two testifiers today? Seeing none, thank you again for accommodating our request to come back today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Members, one thing that I'm going to pass out to you, and we'll have some that we'll leave at the end of the table. I'm going to ask James, our page, to go ahead and start to distribute this to members. And again, there will be some copies if members of the audience would like them. What I had asked the nonpartisan office for the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement to do was to take some of the information that was in the presentations yesterday and just put it into a one-page summary in here so we could see what's current contribution levels, what are proposed changes going to be, how does that affect funding right now if we're at the 7.5% versus the 8%, just so that members wouldn't have to go through 50 or 55 pages of information to try to glean that information, and that we would have something that's maybe in a more of a one-page summary of different kinds of things. So that's the teacher part of me coming through here this morning with that that kind of information. We're going to now move to our bills that we have before us today, and the first bill that we'll be taking up is going to be House File 111, and the author for that is Representative Neuberger, who is here. And as Representative Neuberger is making his way to the testifying table, I will move House File 111 before the committee to be re-referred to the committee on. This is the Committee of Jurisdiction, and what the plan is going to be for this bill and for others like it, because it does have a campaign and elections component in it, and there's oftentimes an omnibus bill that comes out of here. This bill will not have any action taken on it as far as a vote today. It'll just be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And I do believe, Representative Neuberger, that you do have an author's amendment that you would like to offer today. Is that correct?
I do, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to testify, present my bill. I do have this. I would like to have that moved.
Is that the A-17 amendment, which has a change from the word the to aggregate? Am I on the right?
Correct.
All right. Members, questions for the author? Again, it's an author's amendment, technical in nature. All those, I'll move the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We have the bill in front of us the way that the bill author would like it. Representative Neuberger, if you will go ahead with your presentation, and we do have one other amendment that we will address after you are done with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for your time. House File 111 is the result of the last campaign season. End of the season, I had to take a trip out to Washington, D.C. I was at a conference, and I was talking to our fellow representatives from around the country. And we were talking about what we always talk about, political fundraisers. And they were their conversation was how much fun that they had at their fundraisers. And I'm sitting there thinking, really? all of us go to them, all of us hold them, all of us attend those. And generally it's the same pattern. You invite the same eight people. They all show up. You all eat something that's probably not as tasty as it should be. And then you listen to people that you listen to all week talk, and then you go home and you think, man, I wish we could have had some fun. So what my bill does here is, when I was talking to the other representatives from other parts of the country, they were saying, sharing with me how much fun they have raffles. And I don't know if you've been to any of the private organization raffles, but generally there's a lot of fun, there's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of energy, and that's what I'm hoping to bring this next campaign season to our own campaigns. As I was thinking this through, I did make some calls, and the whole intention is one is I want to bring people into the political process. especially now since we no longer have the political contribution refund that seems to be gone currently at this time. But I also wanted to make sure that there were some guardrails built into this bill. And one of the first calls I made was to the gambling board. And we do have the chair of the gambling board here. I believe he's going to testify, and I pitched my idea to him, and I didn't get any real big red flags from him, but he will testify. Maybe he's found one. And I also talked to the Jeff Sigerson, the chair of the campaign finance board, and he has instructed me to say he does not support this bill. He does not oppose this bill, but he is here to make sure that if this does come to fruition, that it will be seamless. That we will try to make this work with the campaign finance board so it's not a big pain in your raffle. Also, the other thing is, and again, I wanted to show you my notes here.
Representative Neuberger,
yeah.
Please keep your day job.
Oh, okay.
Continue.
They'll say amen over here. And I also underlined much quite a bit here as far as how much we should really need some fun in our campaign fundraisers. So the basically what 111 does is the guardrails are, it's just a simple standard raffle like we've always had, and the highlights are you can't hold a raffle during session or special session, off limits. You have to be at least 18 to participate in the raffle. There's a $3,000 aggregate limit, retail value of your prizes. I wanted to have enable people to have some good prizes, maybe some fishing equipment, camping equipment, a game system, that kind of thing. And in order to do that, you have to, we figured $3,000 was a safe number. I didn't want to go above that because if you are, if you don't have a lot of means in your campaign, Representative O'Driscoll has a raffle where he's raffling off a Nintendo game system and his opponent is raffling off an Escalade, that kind of makes it unfair. So that's why we put the $3,000 limit on there to bring some balance there. Candidate campaigns are the only ones that can hold these raffles. No political parties, no PACs, no lobbyists, no other organizations. Only those campaigns that are defined by law. Also, it gets better. Wait, there's more. People close to the campaigns, such as campaign officers, family members, lobbyists, those kinds of folks, are limited to only buying one ticket. Initially, when I had this bill drafted, the reviser sent it back to me, and they were excluded from that. And I said, look, if you exclude these people, no one's going to buy any tickets because these are the only, most of the time, these are the folks that show up to your events. So folks that would have significant influence, one ticket, which also drives you to bring in more people from the outside. You don't need to be present to win. And again, I welcome any input. This is a work in motion. I'd like to see this come through and add a little more fun to our next campaign season. Hopefully enable people to raise a little more money since now we no longer have, at this current time, the campaign refund in place. With that, members, I know this is the best and the most fun bill you'll hear all session, and I look forward to your support.
Representative Neuberger, we do have a member question right now, and
sure.
Then you did indicate that there are some others who might be available to testify. Right now, our first question comes from Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger. I'm sorry your campaign fundraisers aren't fun. You're welcome to come to one of mine. We have some.
Representative Halverson, how do yours differ? No, I'm just kidding.
My question, I don't know if it's for the author or if it might be for staff, but this is an expansion of gambling in Minnesota, and any of those bills that we've ever had come to the legislature always go through the Commerce Committee. So since this is being laid over, it doesn't sound like we're going to hear it in Commerce, and it sounds like we should hear it in Commerce based on what I'm reading here, and I'd recommend to the author that we take it to Commerce, but anybody who could comment on that would be helpful.
Representative Halverson, to that point, we have visited with the Chair of Commerce, and we have not yet heard back, so we're going to keep this bill in our jurisdiction without passing it to a committee that doesn't want it or may not need to see it, or as we continue to have that conversation. That's why it's laying over for possible inclusion, because it would be something that would ultimately be here, so we're not moving it out today. We're not taking action on it. So once we get clarification, we'll find other committees and build jurisdiction if we need to. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an interesting bill. I don't recall seeing anything quite like it. So you mentioned, Representative Neuberger, the example of a Nintendo game system. And obviously, you know, we can't, under state law, with good reason, purchase items of personal appeal or personal, just for personal use, using campaign funds. And there's a good reason for that, I think. You know, I don't see a whole lot of safeguards written into this language. So supposing I purchase said Nintendo game system using campaign funds, or let's maybe not use me as the example. Let's say a nameless representative from some other
district. It's your story, Representative Freiberg. Yeah.
Purchases a Nintendo game system for use in a campaign raffle. There is a provision in here allowing immediate family members to purchase one ticket, which is something of a limitation, I suppose. But suppose my said political candidate's spouse purchases one raffle ticket. The raffle is not advertised in any way, really, to the volunteer base. So, you know, then the candidate's spouse would have a pretty good chance, I would say, of winning that Nintendo game system. I mean, is that a concern to you or anything, that there might be a possibility of abuse of this language or of a way to get to desirable items that would otherwise not be acquirable using campaign funds by candidates?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you for your question. That's an excellent question, and that's part of the reason why we have this process, is because I welcome your input. I would say there's a twofold answer to that. Number one, woe to you if you do that. If you were my opponent and you bought a Nintendo game system with your campaign funds and sold three tickets, one to your wife, one to your son, and one to your daughter, and oh, lo and behold, now we have this game system, and I'm your opponent in the next election or in the election coming up. If I look at the first campaign, we do the two finance reports. We do one in is it July? I believe it's July, and then we do one right before the. We could build into the language that these raffles would have to take place before the first report. But if you were my opponent and you did that, I can guarantee you what my mailers would say. So there's some built-in, just by its own essence, there's built-in protections. And, you know, I would offer, I think that is an excellent idea. And that is something that I would be very willing to craft into this bill as a safeguard. My intention is not to enable candidates to buy fun things with their campaign funds. My intention is to bring fun into campaigns.
Follow-up, Representative Freiberger. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got the A1 amendment that's with this. I figured you did. From my local union, when I ran my local union, we had raffles, and we had raffles for prizes. And as the Representative Neuberg was pointing out, that it's always got sticky when, you know, officers bought tickets and other people bought tickets, and when an officer won the prize, it always raised eyebrows to other people that had bought tickets, and oftentimes it was the person that bought the most tickets, and a lot of times it was the person that was active in the local that did that would win the prize, but it was always better if some member that doesn't normally come to meetings wins the prize. It makes a lot better feelings. But when we did those things, we had to go through the gambling board, and we had to go through all sorts of steps to make sure we were to conduct the raffles and to make sure that we followed the rules of the gambling board. And so, like the amendment I have here, basically that's what it does, is make sure that if campaign's going to run this, they have to go through and comply with the laws of the gambling board. And that's what this amendment does. And so I'd like to offer the amendment, the HO 111A1 amendment, and for that reason, that to make sure that there are safeguards. Again, there are safeguards, there are side rails, so that we're not overseeing so a situation where somebody puts a raffle, buys a nice prize, and then only sells three tickets and guarantees that somebody knows is going to win. I mean, that's what some of this has to do with. So I would I hope that Representative Neuberger will see this as a friendly amendment, but that's I offering the amendment, and I move the amendment.
Representative Neuberger, thoughts to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I actually read your amendment, and I actually read Section 349, which is quite in depth. If you could split your amendment, the part that gives me a little bit of concern is the part D on line 1.7, where you talk about the receipts collected under the subdivision are subjected to all taxes required on raffles conducted by an organization licensed under Chapter 349. As I looked into that, on the federal side of things, we have 501c3s, 501c19s, and 501c4s. All of those are like similar type of organizations. I'm not going to get into the weeds on those because if I did, that'd sound stupid. But suffice to say, they're exempt. At this point, I don't want to bring a federal tax component into this equation. So that's the part. If you're willing to split your amendment and drop 1.7, that the content from there down, I'm okay with that. I do. Like I said, this is a work in progress. I want us to have fun with this. I want people to have a good time and inject a little more into our efforts. And I'm okay with going with the first portion where you're talking about 349. But once you cross that line into 1.17, now we're talking about federal tax issues, and that's something I just don't want. I know that I don't want to bring that into this equation. I'm sure most candidates don't, and I don't think that the campaign finance board or the gambling board would really welcome that as well. I can't speak for them. That's just my assumption.
Representative Nelson, to the amendment.
It's my understanding that the taxes we're talking about here are state taxes, not local, or not federal taxes. And we're talking, and what we're doing is putting these campaigns on par with other groups that have charitable gambling, and that's what we're talking about, are charitable gambling.
Mm-hmm.
That we're putting them on the par with everyone else that has to do that and has to follow the rules and pay the freight for that, and that's why that second part's there. I would like to keep that in the amendment. That's up to the will of the committee, and there are ways to do that. But
Representative Mason, to the amendment.
I guess they would have responses both from the author and Representative Nelson. And my fear is, if you are making this separate from the way other raffles are handled, I think that would place us in an incredibly difficult position.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Representative Mason. As I was looking into this, to this bill, I had some conversations with the folks at the gambling board, and there are a number. Now I'm sure I can be corrected if I'm wrong, and we can call down the chair of the gambling board. But there are a number of organizations that don't have to register; they can have raffles that go up to $1,500, like hockey moms, that kind of thing. I was at a local basketball game a month ago, and some of the moms were walking around selling 50-50 raffle tickets to help support one of the basketball teams. And that clearly would fit, after my conversation with the gambling board, that would clearly fit within that, you know, that jurisdiction. So would this be unique? No. According to my research, there's lots of other groups that are out there that are able to conduct raffles. They're just limited to 1,500. And if you want to drop it down to 1,500, that's fine. Well, it wouldn't be as fun as 3,000, but I'm willing to do that too.
Representative Halverson, to the amendment.
To the amendment, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would not want to give myself as a candidate a leg up against other charitable organizations, and that's what exempting your bill would do. One of the biggest fundraising groups in my community is the Egan Hockey, mm-hmm. and they are very effective with their work with charitable gambling in my community, and I've played some bingo for Egan Hockey over the years. And I would not want to advantage myself in front of those organizations who are doing really important work in our community for the benefit of our kids, for the benefit of our schools, for the benefit of whatever it might be. As a candidate, I don't think that there's any one in the state that wants us to advantage ourselves above somebody else, and that's what exempting us from these laws would do. And so I think this amendment, we absolutely should move forward with it, and I would hope that you would make that change to the bill so that we can, at the very least, make sure there's a level playing field for our charitable organizations.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Representative Halverson, for your input. And again, I welcome that. First of all, I would like to say is that the premise of your comments almost sounds like that these are mandated. No one's going to force anyone to have a raffle. If you're a candidate and there are several organizations in your district that have active raffles and you feel it's not in the best interest to compete with those, then don't have one. If you're a candidate and there are no raffles in your district and you want to have one and everyone wants to have some fun, then go ahead and have one. No one's forcing you to do this. So there's no forced competition here. No one's being mandated to have a raffle. Okay, that's number one. And number two, again, I don't want to put a lot of barriers. I don't want to put in a lot of hoops to jump through when it comes to the tax portion of this. And I'm sure that the chair of the gambling board can speak to this as well. But at the end of the day, what I'm trying to do is just like I said, breathe a little fun into this. And finally, there is one aspect that I'm willing to listen to. All of us with our campaign contributions, or not our contributions, but our campaign funds, we are allowed to give up to $100 to certain charitable organizations. So if you have that meet the criteria, so that if you do have an organization, we could build into this raffle. You are free to, you could say, look, you know, the first $300 that we pull in off this raffle, we're going to give three $100 donations to three different charities in the community. There's all kinds of things that you could do with this that would help.
Further discussion to the amendment,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'd like a roll call.
Roll call being requested. Seeing no other discussion, the clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh? Bliss?
No.
Fenton?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup?
No.
Lee?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash? Nelson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Yeah.
Sandsteed? Swinzinski? Tice?
No.
West?
No.
Joachim?
Yes. We're just grabbing.
She's also.
Sandsteed?
Yes.
It's the amendment.
There being seven ayes and eight nays, the amendment is not adopted to the bill. Representative Joachim, you were on the list of members to talk about the bill.
Yes.
We are now back to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuberger, I'm curious to why you went on the with the raffle aspect. Currently, there's nothing prohibiting a candidate from doing like a door prize mm-hmm. at an event, which can also be very fun mm-hmm. and can be of monetary value. So if your whole intention is to make this fun, how come you didn't think about going that route instead of a raffle route?
Representative Neuberger.
Representative Joachim, because you need not be present to win. When you have door prizes, you're contingent on having large amounts of people show up to make it successful. For a raffle, that's not the case.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll. So I'm still a little confused because if the point is to have fundraisers be fun and people be there, mm-hmm. wouldn't you want them to be present?
Representative Neuberger.
As much as possible, absolutely. But also, what is the primary goal of a fundraiser? funds, raise money for campaigns. And because we no longer have the political contribution refund, I thought that this would be a fun way to help offset that.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll. So, Representative Neuberger, your primary purpose is to raise funds, not as much for the fund. And I'm with you on the campaign finance refund. I wish we could bring that back, and I think we can easily do that with statute. And might be a better option than competing with local charities. Thank you.
Other member questions at this time? Seeing none, is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee today? Good morning and welcome. We do know who you are, but for the record, we'll ask you to go ahead and state your name and the organization you are representing and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board. And interesting discussion from all aspects. Certainly the concern on behalf of the board, the Charitable Gambling Control Board, and that is the key word, charitable. We regulate all the charities and all the activities that go on in the state, as those that might have heard me testify yesterday, $1.5 billion industry in Minnesota. But by no means is this activity or other activity small. It all comes into play in terms of the conduct, who's eligible to win, what's the prizes, what's the amount of the prizes. But I do want to bring attention to this committee and how this bill takes shape, because our efforts regulate charitable gaming. We don't see politicians as charity, and would not qualify, with all due respect, but it would not fit under the jurisdiction of the Gambling Control Board unless there's other law changes. So I throw caution depending upon what amendments take shape in this particular bill. I did have great discussions with the representative in terms of just the conduct and how you conduct a raffle. Somebody was saying door prizes, and that kind of piqued my curiosity. What is a door prize if it's not a raffle? And this is
no money.
Good. But if it's a cost to enter to get into the room, anytime there's a consideration. But those are the kind of questions we get at the board, whether it's from a private citizen that wants to raise money for somebody that's got cancer, a truly worthy cause. But the laws of Minnesota restrict raffles or the conduct of raffles to very select few. That person by themselves could not do it. It has to be a charity. The representative acknowledged parents at a sporting event. There is an allowance, an exemption, for a raffle-type activity to happen at a high school event. That's all under the laws of Department of Public Safety, alcohol and gambling enforcement. It kind of doesn't fit under charitable. So there is a small provision in there. There's a provision under 609 allowing credit unions to encourage savings. So if you deposit more money, your name is eligible to go in there. So that's an area of law that's carved out for exceptions that would presumably. And so that's where the direction was given originally to the representative, that if you're considering this or the legislators, it would fit more appropriately under a 609. I don't want to get public safety in trouble, but there is an issue of a concern. You know, if entry is limited to one and only one chance, who's looking to make sure that there's somebody didn't slide another chance in there, those things. As soon as that high school activity got passed in law, first week we had a call from a parents group complaining that the band group got to the front door before the basketball group. That's one of those things, you know, work it out. And they did. But it's those things that it would not come under the Gambling Control Board unless there's other provisions of allowance to make that happen. So that sidesteps concerns on taxes, equitable rates. Our focus, our concern in anything is just the actual conduct selection, who needs to be present or not, whether you call it a sweepstakes or door prize. So there's a lot of things in play when it truly comes to the conduct of the activity. So the advice I would extend to the author and the committee, what do you want to gain from this? What do you hope to achieve? And then how does it fit under the laws, whether it's public safety or 609 statute? I don't see it, as it's currently written, coming under anything for charitable. So I hope that provides a little oversight and maybe more work that I'd be happy to work with the author or others in terms of if the focus is on the conduct aspect. You know, we have some great rules and laws governing charities and what they're obligated to follow, and the same should apply to others. But depending upon how you want to frame this, lend a hand or not.
We're going to have you stand by because we have at least one member question, but I also have a follow-up on the Joaquin question about a door prize.
Yep.
When I run campaign events, and I think others do as well, I put on there that a suggested donation, which does not mean that there is. If you didn't have that language on your flyer and you gave away a door prize, would you consider that under state law to be a raffle?
If you have that language on your suggested donation, in the laws of Department of Public Safety, as well as, again, the control board, if there's any implied consideration, then it's consideration. So I throw caution your way. In that example, just simply by having suggested donation, they treat that as consideration, one of the three elements, consideration, chance, prize. To remove one or more of those elements, we get calls all the time when the McDonald's restaurant offers a Monopoly game. How can they do that? You look at the fine print on the rules, no purchase necessary. So you should be able to go to McDonald's and ask for a free game piece, and they should give you one. So in your sense, suggested donation, I encourage you, kind of, we can work, but that would be an implied consideration.
It's not an issue because I don't offer door prizes, just to
okay.
The
Now, in fairness, I continue with that if it's okay to spend a little more time. But
sure.
As I said, remove one or more of the options. Consideration. If you're trying to raise money, that's tough to get rid of the consideration. You're trying to get money. Next element is chance, luck of the draw, which we're talking about raffles. But that's where if you've gone to some of the high school hockey events and the chuck-a-puck, so you can go in, you pay a consideration, a buck or two for the puck. It takes the skill to throw the puck to try to get it on center ice. So that's removing the element of chance. Suggestion to the representative, with all due respect, I said if you put your picture up on a wall and charge $5 for darts.
I'd make a lot of money.
You could. But again, the element of skill to throw. So it wouldn't be considered gambling and the like. So there's different mechanisms depending upon what it is you're trying to achieve, but then also live within the confines of the laws.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Barrett, has there been, in your recollection, expansions of gambling in Minnesota that have not had to go through the Commerce Committee?
Mr. Chair and Representative, no. I think, frankly, maybe because I've been around the Gambling Control Board a few years, it wasn't always under Commerce. It was our agency and regulation. Sometimes it was under state government operations. But anytime there was a gaming-type related bill, whether it's charitable, lottery, horse racing, or just this kind of exempt-type activity, there would be an additional view going through the whether it was Commerce or state government ops.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Barrett, for that, because I was not remembering anything that hadn't gone through Commerce before, because we had that conversation about banking and some other exceptions to the regulation of raffles. And what all of those exemptions have had in common is that they were to benefit a public purpose. So to benefit people who are being encouraged to save, to benefit a local youth group, whatever it might be, it's for a public benefit. I think that it is absolutely distasteful to take what has historically Minnesota been a public benefit and turn it around to be used as a benefit for people who are seeking elected office, who are sitting in elected office. And I would really encourage the chair, whoever, to send this on to another committee. It sounds like it needs more work. It sounds like we might not even have the right laws that we're looking to regulate this particular action. So it needs additional work without a doubt. Be it Commerce, be it State Gov, Finance, whatever it might be, this needs to be seen by another committee. And frankly, I wish I had a chance to vote on it because I would vote no. I do not want people in Minnesota to think that we are sitting here for the benefit of ourselves. We're sitting here as public servants of the state of Minnesota, and I take that very seriously. I know everybody in this room takes it very seriously. And true or not, it really does smack of personal benefit over public benefit. And so I'm sorry, Mr. Neuberger, I can't support your bill. I do support fun, so always looking for more ways to have fun, but this is really concerning to me.
Representative Halverson, as I had said, we're going to hold this bill within the jurisdiction of the committee, and as we hear back from others, if they need to see it, some of the issues you just raised again, we should have a chance to address those. Anyone else questions for Mr. Barrett? Others wishing to testify on the matter before the committee today? Seeing none and hearing none, I will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an elections omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill that we're going to be taking up is House File Number 6. Representative Fabian is making his way to the testifying table. And with that, I will, on behalf of Representative Fabian, move House File 6 to be before the committee and to be re-referred to a does this have a re-referral to the Jobs Committee? So, again, House File 6 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Representative Fabian, welcome to the committee. Ask you to go ahead, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your bill, if you would. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I do have the DE-1 amendment. If you would care to move that for me, please, to get the bill in the shape that I'd like.
And members, have you been able to locate the DE-1 amendment in your materials? All right. Again, as customary, the author has asked to have a DE amendment to get the bill in the form that the author chooses. I will move the DE-1 amendment. Any questions on the DE-1 amendment? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the DE-1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Fabian, the bill is now in the order that you would like. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that we started with last year in the last biennium. The reason that I brought the bill forward is I'd like to actually grow the Public Utilities Commission. And what I'd like to do is get more regional representation from around the state. My goal here is not to replace anybody who's currently on the board. We've made provisions in here in terms of getting to where we want to be. My proposal at this time would be that we have 9 members total, 8 of them appointed by congressional district, still appointed by the governor. Anybody who's currently serving on the PUC would continue to serve their full term. And then as we make the steps into the new appointments and the transition, I'll call it, if you turn to page 2, subdivision 2, under section 2, you can see the transition that would start on July 1st of 2017. And then at that point, between then and October 1st of 2017, the governor would appoint commissioners from the 1st, 2nd, 7th, and 8th congressional districts to the terms that begin on January 2nd of 18. And then you can see the succession that would happen in 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22. I've worked a lot with House Research on this to try to get things in the correct order so that we can continue the Public Utilities Commission with the mission that they're charged with. And that's my bill.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Members, questions for Representative Fabian? We'll go with Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Freiberg, I've got you. Quam, I've got you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And remind me, Representative Fabian, what do these commissioners make? I'm not sure. I'm at the back of my mind. What do these people make? So we're adding 4, so we're adding 4 more salaries to the commission. Some people could argue we're growing government. So what do these people make per year on the commission?
You know, I'm going to ask
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going, and Mr. Representative Nelson, I'm going to ask Mr. Elick to come forward. He's the person I've been working with on this bill. I believe it's in the $120,000.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll go ahead and state your name and who you're here with, and proceed with answering the question before the committee.
Mr. Chair, Bob Elick with House Research. Actually, I was advised by staff of your committee this morning that the salary of commissioners is $140,000.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Mr. Chair, the question is that I do like the idea of having more regional, but I understand that where you're coming from on this, that all parts of the state then have a view in this. There is some sense to this. I just want to make sure the fact that we understand that we're raising the cost of government by doing this, and moving forward. And sometimes that's a good thing, but other times we have a lot of people that argue all the time that we need to shrink government, and just want to make sure that we're all aware of that.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Nelson. You know, for me, this is about good government, good governance. And quite frankly, when the average distance that the current PUC members live from the state capitol is 17 miles, quite frankly, I have some concern about that. And I think that it's important that, I'm not necessarily saying anything bad about the current members. You know, we can have that discussion at some point later on. But I do think that it's critical that people that live in my part of the state have representation, people that live in far southwestern Minnesota have representation. And the way that I've found it best to do is to do it by appointments by congressional districts. And, you know, currently there's no one from north of the metro area that serves on the PUC. Recently, I did an interview, and one of the interviewers asked me about, well, are you suggesting that people from, you know, the metro area can't represent people from, say, northern Minnesota? And I said, well, if that's the litmus test, then why don't we just appoint five people from Roseau County to the PUC and, you know, do it that way? So I think that this is good government. I think that the regional representation, Representative Nelson, that you referred to, is really critical. There are so many issues that come before the PUC. And as I said in that same interview, I think we need another perspective. We need more perspectives to get to good decisions at the end. And then, of course, the ninth member is appointed by the governor at large.
Representative Nelson, follow-up? Representative Nelson, follow-up? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Representative Nelson actually took one question I was going to ask. I was going to ask a follow-up. You know, I looked at the PUC's website. It looks like they meet approximately once a week in St. Paul. Right now there is a requirement that at least one PUC member be from Greater Minnesota. Does that member get a per diem, housing allowance, anything like that? I'm wondering if that would be a component of this as well.
Representative Fabian, are you able to answer that question for us this morning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Freiberg, I'm not exactly sure on what their per diem is, but with a salary of $140,000, I think that you know, that's pretty substantial. Maybe you and I could get appointed to that board.
Yeah. They already had our humor bill before that. Representative Freiberg.
Thanks. Just an unrelated question. This is more just kind of a statutory construction. I just realized I didn't know the answer. This does put, the fact that there are eight congressional districts in Minnesota into the state statute requires one from each of the eight. You know, there's some speculation that Minnesota might lose a congressional district after the next census. Will the legislature then have to revisit the language here, or what is the, or is there some process statutorily in place to correct those references?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we have talked about that, and we'll need to cross that bridge when we get to it. And, you know, in committee at one point I said last year, if we got to that point, we would just have eight members. And they said, well, then how do you break a tie? And I said, well, you just have to be more Garofalo-esque in your arguments so that you can get a 5-3 decision. And of course, that was in Garofalo's committee. So,
Representative Freiberg, maybe we don't want to telegraph that we would be okay with seven congressional districts.
Yeah, no, I certainly hope that doesn't happen, but I was curious about the process there.
Follow-up? No. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fabian. I like the idea of the electing from, I'm very familiar with the utility co-ops and how they have members, elected across the different regions, and they seem to have a very good working relationship. What mechanism is there to currently and in future in the bill remove a commissioner?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to be clear, this is not electing. This is appointing by congressional district. Okay? The DE-1 amendment makes it an appointment. Okay? Just to be clear on that. And then I see Representative...
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yeah. No, I realize that. I was just saying that I was... Your original format of the bill was something I enjoyed. So because that was changed through amendment, then I'm curious as to how the people, either by themselves or through their legislators, could actuate the removal of a member.
Okay.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Quam, originally, you know, my bill did have an election, but I've kind of jettisoned that because it would require, I believe, a constitutional amendment, and that would have been, you know, how much we all like constitutional amendments around here. So I'll refer to Mr. Eloff on the possible removal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, the existing statute states that removal of members is governed by Section 15.075, which I think Mr. Gehring can give us some background on that.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yes, so 15.0575 is the current law that applies to the PUC and will continue to apply, and that allows for removal of a member only for a cause after notice in a hearing, so you have to have a specific reason to remove someone. A member could also be removed if they miss three consecutive meetings.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, but the mechanism, you know, the body that's allowed, is that the governor? Is it the board itself? Is it the legislature?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, so it's the appointing authority that has the authority to remove someone, so it would be, in this case, the governor.
Representative Quam. Representative Joachim.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, my concern with the increasing of the boards, as a few have mentioned already, is the increased cost. Are there FTEs that are support those board members that might have to be increased as well?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a possibility, yes. And I'll be asking for a fiscal note on this, so when we get our next stop, we'll have that, okay?
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I know that normally this is a policy committee, so we don't talk about finance, but we all know that they all go hand in hand. And I know recently Chair Anderson had requested state departments to look at, and I'm assuming boards and commissions, to look at flat fee, if not a flat budget, if not a 10% cut. So how do you think that would fit into what we're looking at in the budget outlay this year?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and it's kind of like if we go to seven congressional districts, I guess we'll, when we get targets and so forth, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. And I respect your concern, and it is a concern of mine as well.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Other member questions at this time on House File 6, which is before the committee? Anyone from the public or other having an interest in the matter before the committee today wish to testify? Anybody else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Fabian will give you the final word on the bill this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, members, and thank you very much for hearing this bill. There's probably a little more work to do on this. We've got a couple of issues that have arisen here, you know, and even as I look at some things, there may be some other additions or corrections to the bill. I'm happy to work with folks on this, and let's get a good product in the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. I renew my motion that House File 6 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Fabian, you are on your way.
Thank you.
And our final bill this morning is Representative Lean, and there he is, has House File 172 before the committee this morning. Representative Lean, welcome to the committee, and I will move House File 172 before the committee for consideration, and I believe we are going to be re-referring this today to the Committee on Property Taxation. If I am not mistaken, I will clarify that to the Taxes Committee, and they'll deal with it from there. So, Representative Lean, I move House File 172 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Welcome, and state your name, and go ahead and begin with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. It would be going to taxes or the property and local government division?
It will go to taxes, and they can then decide internally to bring it to their division,
gotcha.
My understanding.
Okay.
So if we have a referral problem, we'll certainly get it taken care of because it's technical.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, House File 172 is a local option sales tax bill and bonding authority bill for a new jail and law enforcement center in Clay County. The tax would be a one-half-cent sales tax for 20 years or until sufficient funding for the project has been generated. The cost of the new jail and law enforcement center will be $52 million. In addition to the sales tax, Clay County will finance bonds with levy dollars, maturing debt, wind energy taxes, and lease payments from the City of Moorhead for space in the law enforcement center. The sales tax was approved by voters at the November 2016 general election by a vote of 66% to 34%. The sales tax is also supported by the Moorhead Business Association, which is an organization of area businesses. The tax may expire sooner than 30 years by county ordinance if we have generated enough revenue, enough funding. Mr. Chair and members, I will now introduce County Commissioner Grant Whalen to provide additional testimony on the bill.
Mr. Whalen, welcome to the committee. I ask you to introduce yourself and state your position here today and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Grant Whalen. I'm a Clay County Commissioner. We are here today to ask for your support on a very important matter to the citizens of Clay County, approval of a local sales tax to help pay for construction of our new jail and law enforcement center. Clay County is the county, the city of Moorhead is the county seat for Clay County and lies adjacent to the city of Fargo, North Dakota. We currently have the oldest jail and correctional facility in the state of Minnesota, constructed in 1966. We do not meet the 2911 rules promulgated by the Department of Corrections and have been working vigorously with the Department of Corrections to continue use of our facility. We are currently under an exemption as we have made improvements and promised construction of a new facility. We continuously board 40 to 60 prisoners per day to other counties. I think in December we had well in excess of 60 prisoners a day we were sending out. We are transporting prisoners to Crookston, Minnesota, which is 65 miles away, and many times to Douglas County, which is 100 miles away, and even counties that are further than that. So it's amounted to considerable expense for us over the last several years. We are a small taxing entity saddled with big city problems. The Moorhead-Fargo metropolitan area is in excess of 200,000 population and thus carries with it the bigger city problems, such as criminal activity more commonly seen in areas of larger populations. We are the gateway to the oil field activities of North Dakota and are feeling the negative effects of the oil boom. Mental health issues are a major concern and problem to most of our prisoners, yet we do not have the ability in our jail to meet the needs of the prisoners or the providers of service to the prisoners. We are a farming community with big city liabilities, and our farmland is currently being taxed beyond capacity. According to the state auditor's data site, Clay County was ranked 79th of 87 counties in our taxing capacity in 2012. Unfortunately, our citizens cannot afford to build a new jail. Clay County has begun to prepare for jail construction. We have started to increase our levy slightly, and I think Representative Leon already addressed these issues. So with the support of the Moorhead Business Association, the local Chamber of Commerce, the Clay County Sheriff's Association, Moorhead Police Department Association, and endorsed unanimously by the Clay County Commission, the citizens passed a referendum on November 8th with 66% of the vote wishing to enact a 1.5 cent sales tax to help pay for our new correctional facility and joint law enforcement center. So I'm here today asking for your support and passage of House File 172 for the purpose of imposing a local sales tax of 0.5% to pay for these facilities. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Whalen, thank you for your testimony. Members, Representative Lean, other testifiers this morning? Okay. Members, questions for Representative Lean or Commissioner Whalen this morning on the matter before the committee? I'm sorry, is this on the questions? Are we all out of questions? My goodness. Representative Lean, I will just make a quick comment from a procedural standpoint. You had talked about your voters in Clay County, and Commissioner, you as well, had voted on this, and that's an anticipatory vote that is oftentimes done with these local sales tax referendums requests for referendums on this and authorization by the legislature, that there be a clear understanding from the people that they would support this, and that's why you probably heard there was the election before the authorization. And tax gets to decide with all the other issues. Why is it here? Because it's changing government operations for Clay County, and that's within our jurisdiction. So, again, no other questions. Representative Lean, we will give you the final word on the bill this morning.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I certainly do appreciate your time and attention to this issue this morning, and this is a very big issue for Clay County. I mean, we do have the oldest jail in the state. Department of Corrections has been taking beds out of commission, so to speak, and so not only do we have the issues, being a rather large metropolitan area with a relatively small tax base, largely ag tax base, so we are having to house people that come to the metropolitan area from other states, North Dakota, but then we also are having to spend money, largely $500,000 to $1 million a year, housing prisoners in other counties. So this is a big issue for us, and with your support, we would appreciate to move on to the tax committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, I renew my motion that House File 172 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Representative Lean, you are on your way. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, members.
Again, if you would just be so kind as to take your paperwork out of your folders and set it aside, that will help our staff immensely. And with that, no other business before the committee. We are adjourned.